Oh, hey there, I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to a special Independence Day edition of Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. We are posting this episode early, so you can blast it from the speakers at whatever July 4th pool party or barbecue you are at. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining are digital strategist Winter Mitchell.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. Winter, what are you declaring independence from this year?
Bad news!
All right, fair. Journalist and novelist Margaret Wappler.
Hi, Guy.
Margaret, what are you declaring independence from this year?
Bad food.
Ooh!
Okay.
That's fair.
We've got pop culture scholar and dyke about town, Karen Toxin. Karen, what are you declaring independence from?
Email.
Oh, really?
Yeah, bold. I'm just like, you know, I have an away message.
One of our first weeks here, a real uppity Margaret Wappler talked about 3 days she had spent without.
They crucified me, Karen. When I said this, it was just like, they were all like, who do you think you are? Rocky in the beginning.
We had just met Margaret, and we were like, oh, how much are hot stones a part of this woman's life?
Little did we know. A lot.
And me, Guy Branum, I'm going to be declaring independence from the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland.
Oh, why?
Just because that's
Brexit?
A lot of reasons. Coming up on this week's show, we're going to be talking about works of art where artists declared their independence. Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest gems. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Karen Toxin, what are you all about this week?
As you can hear from my voice, I hope that this isn't a very literal title that I'm reading out loud to you now. It's the new Showtime show, period piece called I'm Dying Up Here. And it's a show set in the 70s. It's a period drama about the stand-up comedy scene in L.A., purportedly about the Comedy Store. But it's a fictionalized account of all of these events.
Lightly fictionalized. Like, you have Melissa Leo is a clear cipher for Pauly Shore's mom. You know, you have Al Madrigal playing Freddie Prinze Jr.'s dad.
Freddie Prinze Sr. And, you know, and you have Melissa Leo, who's really fantastic as this kind of matriarchal, like kind of twisted matriarchal club owner, promoter, booking agent, a sort of Fagin to the comedic urchins of her venue called Goldie's on the show. I am a sucker for period pieces, for period set television, as you might have discerned from my many choices on this podcast. And I think they really nail the 70s in Los Angeles in a kind of beautiful way. There are portions of the first episode where I found myself resisting some of the narrative, particularly the dynamic between the kind of haunting figure of one comic who suffers an untimely death and one of the main characters played by Ari Grainer, who I guess her character is based on Elaine Boozler. Anyway, but it's fascinating. It's only a couple of episodes in, so it's not too late to jump in and check it out, especially if you're a fan of comedy, a fan of the history of comedy. I don't know what it's like, though, to be a comedian and watching it.
The world of, like, the communities in stand-up, the kind of community that stand-up comedy is always something I would like to see represented in some way, and it's very hard. And, this is attempting it for, like, a club where people are having successes. I'd rather watch something about open micers. Like, that's a little more interesting to me. My issues with it were two things. Just the need to be very dramatic about it and very Tears of a Clown, and there is something sort of tragic that happens to a guy right after he does his first Tonight Show set in the pilot that was a little bit just like heavy-handed for me. And then the old school problem of they cast stand-up comedians to play all of the male stand-up comedians and then an actress to play the female stand-up comedian. And it probably doesn't feel like an issue if you haven't been paying close attention to it, but like it's what they did in
the Tom Hanks.
The Sally Field in Punchline. I was actually thinking of Funny People with Adam Sandler,
right,
where they got what's her name from Parks and Rec.
The heavy-lidded one.
Yes. but it is just sort of like...
Aubrey Plaza.
Aubrey Plaza. But I am invested in watching it because Andrew Santino is my friend, and it is...
Who?
Andrew Santino, the redhead. It is a world of people who, it's too close to my world not to watch it.
They got the Ryan Hyatt, like, they nailed, I don't know how they got the topographical backdrop of East Sunset from what's now called the Andaz that way, but that was pretty dope.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, they really managed to give you a feel of what the Sunset Strip was like in the 1970s.
And it's especially
amazing.
The
I
Comedy
don't know
Club
that.
Is a specially built soundstage. And of course, their hangout is still Cantor's, which looks exactly the same. But anyway, it's a gorgeous watch at the very least. And there's enough kind of humor and plot driven interest in it that I think people get into it.
Yeah.
Wonder what are you all about this week?
Oh my gosh, you guys. Alert, alert, alert. This is my new shit. And I think this show is going to be on 5-6 seasons. It's called Claws. It's the new Niecy Nash show.
Hello.
Hello is exactly. Hello, hello.
Yes. So tell people about it.
So essentially, Niecy Nash plays a nail salon owner in like an armpit part of Florida. She has four really sassy sidekicks. Have to name check Carrie Preston. Jesus
Christ.
God, she is so
She's so fucking good at everything.
Everything. But she's going to get a fucking Emmy.
And that salon is laundering money for the mob or something like that, right?
Yes. And then there's three others. Judy Reyes plays like a very mysterious lesbian sort of bodyguard for the rest of the girls. There's two other girls, Karrueche Tran, okay. But then the other blonde woman, I don't know her name, but she's amazing too. But I also have to name check Harold Perrineau. He plays Niecy Nash's brother. So essentially she is running this nail salon, but it's also a front for money laundering, like you said, Guy. And she was promised at the end of the year of getting, I'm not spoiling anything, it's in the pilot. She was promised at the end of the year of getting a bunch of money for doing this, which seemed pretty freaking low for what she was doing, the kind of money she's pulling in. She's also banging like a Vanilla Ice, like Paul Wall looking motherfucker. And then all hell breaks loose when she doesn't get the money that she was promised. From these, like, hicks.
But it looks messy and soapy
it's
and funny.
Messy and soapy and funny.
I saw the trailer at the TCAs, and I was very excited for it. And Niecy's a goddamn talent.
Here's the thing. Like, these are the kind of women that you don't typically see put in. Like, this they would be like a Law & Order episode. They've got an entire series to play around with, the whole playground to play around with, and these are the kind of women that you go and you deal with in a transactional manner, and then you walk away from. And it's taking their story, and that's why I love Harold Perrineau's character. He plays her brother, who's autistic, and just like he brings that like realness to it, just because he is highly functioning autistic, but he's also whom she has her charge. There's just so many emotional, like there's just.
One of the magical things about the Magic Mike movies was just sort of reminding us that Armpit Florida does exist, and it is a rich territory.
And people want to get out of
full
it.
Full of people's lives. Yes. Yeah.
I think at some point we're going to have to do a Florida 2 episode.
We do, because they said something in the second episode last night that was like, so-and-so did something in Hialeah. And then she was like, that sounds like Hialeah. And it's only like, I'm not from there, but I've definitely been to Hialeah Falls, which is north of Miami, and it's ratchet as fuck. Shit goes down there that's crazy as hell. And this show really highlights all the craziness that Florida gives you.
It seems like Claws is high ratchet. Can we say that? Yeah.
No, it's not. It's definitely like these girls aren't charging you $35 for a mani and pedi. They're charging you $20 and you have to pay $5 in the ATM. I mean, it was
production values.
It was
are
the
high
production
ratchet.
Values are good. But it's honestly really good. For TNT.
Oh, it's TNT. I was going to ask
TNT.
What network. Yeah.
Ms. Wobbler, what are you all about this week?
I'm all about Eden Lapucky's new novel, which is called Woman Number 17. Granted, I'm extremely biased because Eden is a friend of mine and also one of my 3,000 employers as a freelancer. But she is a stellar author, and it's so amazing to see her coming more and more into her own. For those of you who don't know her work, she really broke out with her 2014 novel called California, which is the book that Sherman Alexie came on to the Stephen Colbert show and basically said, hey, Amazon, let's fuck them over by ordering this book online en masse. And so that's what happened, and it became a bestseller. And it became a bestseller also because it's really good. And with Woman Number 17, she switches. California had more of like this dystopia angle. Woman number 17 switches to a kind of noir take, and it's set in the Hollywood Hills, and it basically concerns these two different women who are both mothers and both bad mothers. And one is named Lady and the other is named Esther. Lady is basically, she has a memoir coming out, and it's based on a magazine article that she wrote about her 18-year-old son, Seth, who's this really charismatic kid who nevertheless is, he's never spoken, though he doesn't have a disability or anything like that, but he communicates with sign language, his iPad, his Twitter feed. He's just like this really unusual boy. And she hires a nanny named Esther, who she doesn't realize. Esther is actually engaged in this performance art project where she's basically mimicking her mother's own young adulthood. And so the two of them are kind of interacting with each other, not realizing certain dynamics about their relationship that are at play. And, you know, I saw Eden read a number of sections from the book at various readings, and her writing is just studded with these gems, like these really wry observations that outside of whatever's going on with the plot machinations, it's just a fun, wry, delicious kind of read where, like, she'll say something, you'll be like, I've never thought of that before, but that's completely true. So it's a great summer read if you're the kind of person that likes to read something still smart and seductive, but has page turner kind of qualities. Girl on the Train, if you like that book, you should pick this up because the author of Girl on the Train just recommended this book.
Oh, that's mm-hmm. awesome.
Yeah.
This week, I am all about a TED Talk.
Oh.
It was a TEDx talk in Ireland, but by an American, by Dr. James O'Keefe. And he was explaining his theory as to when his son was 18 years old, his son came out to him, and it was him sort of like with his evolutionary theory for why homosexuality exists. And it's been sort of like handed around by a lot of queer people I knew on Facebook. And basically he sort of argues that gay people exist in society to be helpers, that the reason that you're more likely to have a gay child. No, we're going to get there, Karen. that the reason you are more likely to have gay children after, or a gay son after having had several sons, or that a woman who had during pregnancy experienced trauma was more likely to have a gay son, was to have a cooperative child who was not competing for resources with the other sons. And it was weird to see gay men I knew sharing this as like this sounds good. This makes me sound valuable. And it was like, what a nice theory for straight people. Like, it is essentially
exactly.
a my best friend's wedding construction, or not even my best friend's wedding. Mm-hmm. It's like, it is an attempt to scientifically explain why gay people were built to be friends in movies. Karen, thoughts?
Why there was a will for grace. Wow. I mean, does that only work for gay sons? Does it work, like, you know, because I don't think dykes can be all that helpful. I mean, you know,
I'm going to tell you from personal experience, you're not.
Sometimes we are. We're very handy. Some of us are very nurturing and handy. But for the most part, it's just like, leave me alone.
Well, his assertion is that, like, raising your own child, you are perpetuating 50% of your own genes. But if you are in some way able to help, like, your siblings' children, helping two of your siblings' children exist perpetuates your genes as much as having your own child, which isn't mathematically mm-hmm. or genetically true. But it was just such a – it was lovely and horrifying to watch all of these straight people – like politely pat themselves on the back for understanding that there was some genetic role for gay people. And also there was a wonderful cutaway at one moment when he explained that many of you may have gay genes that just have not been activated epigenetically. And you had to cut away to like straight guy in audience looking to his girlfriend with, yeah, what if I have gay genes?
Yeah. I mean, this is also where science has always gone wrong around, like, this is how science fucks up when it tries to find an explanation or a purpose for gayness, right?
Right.
Like, I think, you know, like your good old 90s Simon LeVay, gay hypothalamus and the small shriveled part of it, you know, like,
right.
or whatever. These behavioral and scientific explanations just really often, so often miss the mark and end up being far more insulting than helpful.
Well, it's crowded.
It actually just justified the plot for the next best thing.
Like, it's, totally. It's crowded with nice ideas, like gay people are more likely to have like high emotional intelligence, and it's like, no, out gay people are like, you know, maybe out gay.
Is this man a homosexual?
No.
Okay, all of this feels pretty
like,
invalid.
It was like watching him show photos of his children and sort of explain that one of his children's purpose in life is to make things easier for his children who will do the real work of genetic reproduction.
Oh, God.
Why did you watch this?
Because it was like
so many of your friends were sharing.
My friends were sharing it, and it was like.
So what were they seeing in it that was encouraging to them?
Like the fact that there was some sort of like, Margaret, we exist in a world where like there aren't.
Does he look like Ryan Gosling?
No, that we exist in a world where there aren't too many explanations for why we exist, or in a good way. And these are people who, you know, this was sort of like nice friends, but guys who are like. Sell stuff or program things and, you know, don't think about stuff like that often. And it's better than their mom saying they're going to hell. This was just so TED Talky and had such nice graphics with it that everyone was really ready to be on board.
Yeah, it sounds so TED Talky in the way that, like, it's like an Ouroboros effect where, like, yeah. whatever their kind of speeches are also just end up eating their own yeah. tail. Do you yeah. know what I mean?
Well, it's also one of those things of treating a medical doctor as though he were an academic.
Right.
It's a danger. All right. You're listening to Pop Rocket. We're going to be right back to talk about independence after this.
Well, hoopity dop dop, scoopity dig dop, deepity dabity doobity hoppity hoop. Hoopity doo doo, de papity dee dee, do 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 good do. Duh. Whoopity doo doo, a rabbity hey hey, whoopity ha, it's a papa doo, baby. Doop a doo doo doo, but think it da da, doo doo doo, sit up.
Stop podcasting yourself. We don't even know anymore.
Find it on MaximumFun.org or wherever you download your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. All the women who independent, throw your hands up at me.
Winter Mitchell.
Hey, Margaret Wappler.
And Karen Tongson.
Not Lucy Liu.
So we thought in honor of Independence Day, we would talk about some works where people really did declare their independence, where people set out on their own and declared that they were no longer going to be part of something else. This is a vague construction, maybe. We'll see how this goes. Maybe we'll just end up talking about movies like The Patriot, where America fights for actual independence.
Ouch.
But I did want to try talking about, I mean, like the biggest one in recent memory was Lemonade, which was a text. And I had been calling, this is just me congratulating myself, I've been calling forever that the album after Beyonce breaks up with Jay-Z would change all of us. I was short-sighted enough not to realize that she would declare her independence and declare her journey, but stay with Jay-Z.
And promptly get pregnant with twins.
Right.
Yes. So, like, Margaret, how did you react to Lemonade as a text of independence?
Oh, I mean, it was so inspiring. I mean, although the thing that was so incredible about Lemonade, too, is that she grabbed certain signifiers, cultural signifiers that have been used to hold black women down and turn them into like beautiful constructions of power.
Yeah.
I mean, I think about the fact that she made, I'm forgetting exactly which video, but she made it in that Louisiana slave like plantation house,
yeah.
basically, and just danced all over that plantation house. And like she owned the place and she
right.
does own the place.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, has Serena Williams there, you know, somebody who just like embodies power with her actual physical body. So I think that it was really powerful just for those kind of signifiers alone, you know, being on top of the cop car. while it's sinking in the Katrina kind of waters. So many of the symbols there were basically to say, like, hey, there are so many, like, horrific, damaging narratives in this country in terms of how they affect Black women. But still, in all of this, I can grab it and have power.
Well, one of the very interesting things was the relationship between, like, ownership and complexity and animosity. Like, with Daddy Lessons, taking a country song, like, this is a Texas girl. And sort of, like, you know, with that duet with the Dixie Chicks, reasserting, like, these traditions are mine as well, but these are also traditions that are rooted in things that are super damaging to me and who I am. It was astoundingly bold and smart. All right.
We've given Lemonade a lot of shine on this podcast.
Okay. Shall we move along? You want to talk about Stevie Nicks? You want to talk about Tina Turner? We've got options.
Talk about Tina Turner.
Talk about Tina Turner.
I think that Tina Turner, like, you know, the thing is, I always ask my mom and dad, did you know that Ike was beating her ass? And they were like, eh, I mean, you know, it was implied. His prowess, like how he would address them was legendary. Like, you know, he had all these women in line, including Tina. And so I always reconcile how when she did come out with What's Love Got to Do with It, how it felt like it really empowered, like, my mom, and how she was like, that's when she started telling me about, I learned a lot of things about real life via pulp culture, through the person who was going through it. That's what made it safest for my mom to share that conversation. So when I was like, why do you love this song so much? Why are you playing it all the time? She's like, because I used to beat her ass. And then she said she's leaving. And then now she's got control. And that is, you know, my mom was always sort of showing me those women that were taking control of their brand or their whoever that may be. You know, when Janet did it, you know, I've always sort of leaned towards women doing that. And so I appreciate Lemonade, but I always appreciate, like, when it was born from literally, I have to leave this man or I will be dead. Literally, my family is filled with fucking nutcases. I can't be assigned to this bullshit.
We've had a lot of pop music biopics in the past 30 or 40 years, but I always feel like What's Love Got to Do with It, the movie, is elevated by the fact that it's got a more of a purpose than Coal Miner's Daughter. Like, Coal Miner's Daughter is...
Oh, I don't know. I love Coal Miner's Daughter. Step off.
That's fair, and she is declaring independence from that coal mine.
Well, and, like, an abusive, poverty-stricken childhood.
But, like the intensity of Angela Bassett recounting how much money she has in her purse and sort of, like, having to say, I am here starting from nothing.
Yeah.
Where do I go now? Yeah. It's amazing.
It's just like J-Lo in Enough.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in general those...
Exactly like that.
Exactly. I think in general those, like, domestic abuse breakout stories that I think of as being really seminal to, like, the 80s and the 90s.
Yeah.
Like starting with the first movie that I can really remember making waves is The Burning Bed.
Right, yes.
Remember that?
Tell young people about The Burning Bed.
Yes.
The Burning Bed, I want to say, came out in, like, maybe the mid-80s,
yes,
and it was Farrah Fawcett.
Made
a dramatic
TV.
Turn for Farrah Fawcett.
Dramatic turn. I mean, taking this woman who primarily was known for looking cute on skateboards and having great bangs and showing her in this relationship that was, you know, completely abusive, and she eventually gains the power to leave. And it was the first time on TV that a movie showing that kind of violence between a man and a woman had really ever been shown.
And then it just came out. Then they just started pushing him out.
Everybody watched it.
Yeah.
Well, also, I would say that I've been talking to my mom a lot recently, but, like, I feel like women in the 80s needed that narrative of you can leave and it will not be the worst thing, because they had really been convinced that economic viability depended on them being the junior partner in a relationship with a man. And so, yeah, if we got a lot of domestic, like, breakup sort of stories after that, maybe we needed them.
Well, it was the generation that came to sort of the first generation to come to maturity, like, after, you know, it was pretty much accepted and acceptable to be under the thumb of your husband in the mid-century, right? So it's like the kids of those people whose moms, they probably saw their moms take a hand or a pistol whip or whatever it is. And so, and they were themselves like at the kind of teetering point, you know, of do I get out of, like, I don't have to follow that. I don't have to feel that way. I don't have to follow that path. Feminism has happened and, you know, like in the 70s, and now I can find a way, or I'm going to have to find a way to get out of this, not just, you know, for my own personal pride, but because it is a matter of life and death.
Right.
Because, you know, they saw so many other lives destroyed in this way in the past, probably very intimately to them, including their mothers and their aunts or whoever.
Right.
I think what's powerful, too, about What's Love Got to Do with It is that it really did open up a conversation of, well, how are you supposed to feel about someone who's famous and a great musician, but who is still an absolute piece of shit
asshole
in terms of how he treats women?
But that probably hasn't come up since Ike Turner, right?
Well, Chris, well, yeah.
But, you know, it started conversations not only about Ike Turner, but somebody like James Brown and like Phil Spector and these other men that were powerhouses in their time, but were complete, I mean, control freaks. Mm-hmm. Not just the domestic abuse, but controlling and using the control vis-a-vis their career.
Exactly.
You know, not only just like sex and love, but well, and their finances.
If you're Tina Turner, you've got to look at all those Ronnie Spectors and think, that could be me. Yeah. I could be that girl ground into the dust for leaving him.
100%.
Another work of independence that I deeply, deeply love, also about a breakup, is Nora Ephron's Heartburn. Where after a career of being a journalist and having this power relationship, again, a power relationship that was like such a part of her identity, she breaks off. She writes her first novel. Her novel is about her breakup. Her novel is dishing all of the dirt in a like thinly veiled narrative about her husband, Carl Bernstein. But it's like its determination to make the narrative mine and also sort of express that she was going from a journalist and somebody who writes funny things to somebody who made works, to somebody who was a like an artist and a voice in her own right. It's just so powerful.
Yeah, how many female authors were just, you know, considered typists or given credit as typists? Wasn't there just a story recently that came out about that? That and we also just have right now the story of Yoko Ono being given songwriting credit for Imagine,
right?
Where, you know, where she was deeply a collaborator of John Lennon's from the moment they met, pretty much, you know, and right. And it takes whatever, however many 40 years to actually acknowledge, and which something that he said so himself in the 80s, shortly before he died, that she was a co-creator.
Yeah.
And not just, you know, this bad, quote unquote, Oriental chick who broke up the Beatles.
Yeah, I mean, I think that exists, too, in literary history as well, where, you know, there was a lot of questions recently about Nabokov's wife, Vera, you know, and like that she was an absolute crack editor and apparently took his books always to the next level. And people think even like wrote some of them, but she was still hiding behind kind of his construction. And, you know, same with Zelda and Fitzgerald. Like, we'll never know how much those women really did wield power in those works.
The thing I think is funniest is, you have the movie Irreconcilable Differences.
Oh, yes.
Which is essentially about what's his name who made
It's about Polly Platt, and it's about Polly Platt, who was married to Last Picture Show director Vich. It's coming to me. It'll come to me.
So
Bogdanovich.
Bogdanovich. Oh, so, and Polly Platt.
So it is a movie about a woman who is essentially subsumed into her husband's artistic career and then breaking out on her own and declaring independence. But that movie is made by Nancy Meyers and Charles Schuyler, who then like
they put it from Drew Barrymore's point of view, and it makes her also guilty for making this selfish decision, even though she had no choice.
And I just love that, like, Nancy Meyers is still in her relationship where she is giving all of the credit to her husband, and it won't be until Something's Gotta Give that she is able to sort of, like, break out and make the movie that's her story. Mm-hmm. And there is something beautiful about people having to tell these stories and retell these stories to sort of, like, get the strength and sense of self to go out on their own.
Right, right.
Did Cher ever have to declare her independence? Or do we think that
Moonstruck
would have been it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, she really does have... That period when she leaves pop music and mm-hmm. becomes an actress really is the time when she is defining herself.
Right. As an artist, as more than, just a pop star, right?
Yeah, and, like, it is so fascinating to hear her stories of how much Sonny meant to her and, like, what control he had over her sense of self and stuff.
The thing that I think is legendary about her, beyond just being Cher, is that she goes and makes all these movies and doesn't really pick a bad one in the bunch. People will argue about Witches of Eastwick, but I thought that was an amazing movie.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I don't blame her for being in it. I think the movie was, kind of flawed, but right. I love looking at the picture,
Me too.
The poster.
Me too. So then she goes back and sits on in the Navy ship and turns back time. And it's like, she like... couch the 80s in like ownership of self. I really feel like she did, if anybody did the 80s from 80 to 89 well, she's one of them.
And then she believed in life after
and
love.
She believed in life after
just
love.
In time for me to come out of the closet. That was so perfectly timed. We've been talking a lot in terms of women in relationships declaring independence, but a novel about independence I really wanted to talk about was Salman Rushdie's Midnight's Children, which is specifically about India declaring independence from Great Britain. It's about 100 kids who are born around the time that India becomes independent, and they all have superpowers. But the thing I love most about it is its first chapter is just declaring dependence. Like, it is just referencing a passage to India and the tin drum and absolutely everything that ties Salman Rushdie to Europe and European, like, literary traditions. And he builds all of that stuff up before he says, all right, I'm going off on my own. And there's something so wonderful about that in independence, of having to sort of, like, first recognize all of the ways that you are part of somebody else's story before you can tell your own story. Right.
I can't remember. Did that book come out post-Fatwa or pre-Fatwa?
That was pre-Fatwa.
Okay.
That was, like, that had come out and gotten its respect before the Satanic Verses came out.
Yeah, because, I think he is an interesting... I mean, his whole career is an interesting story of independence, waged again and again through his works. I mean, he's not only from the obvious sort of, like, colonialist, taking colonialist narratives and turning them on their heads, but then also just like being willing to go against the powers that be in so many twists and turns in his career.
Yeah, I mean, like, he's ready to pick a fight, which is kind of a thing that I want in a novelist, as long as it's a smart fight. I will always have respect for somebody who can win the Booker Prize and then the Booker of Bookers and will still be in a Bridget Jones movie. Like, that's somebody who's making
that's
his own
sweet
rules
spot for sure.
For sure.
Totally. Can I make a pitch for a Declaration of Independence?
Please.
And, it's not a love relationship, or it's not like an intimate partner relationship, but it's certainly a familial relationship, and it's Sofia Coppola. Every film she's directed is a Declaration of Independence and a kind of redemption from being enlisted into Godfather 3 and being, completely humiliated
Unpack
by that whole encounter. Well, Francis Ford Coppola had another actress cast in
Winona
that
Ryder.
Role, Winona Ryder. And I can't remember if Winona fell ill or something happened last minute. And so he had to make a casting decision, and he went with what was nearby. And because he had faith in his daughter, and cast Sophia in this role. And if you may recall, it was not very well received. It's perhaps one of the most widely panned performances ever. She received like a gazillion Razzie nominations and awards. And then like every critic was out for her. And it was a sort of emblematic,
the movie
nepotistic.
Was otherwise like just okay, but then she
took
somehow,
a fall for the movie.
Yeah, she made it 0% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Exactly. So she basically took all the hits.
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh, that poor girl, she's never gonna have a career.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, she starts making her own films, and it's like later pops. I'm the voice of a new generation.
Yeah.
So I think we gotta give it up to her for doing that.
Well, yeah, and movies that are so removed from his very male, very sort of like turgid approach to things. Like, you know, can there be a movie further from what he does than Somewhere or whatever or that movie?
Virgin Suicides, yeah. Or, you know.
Yeah, I mean, their choices about what stories they want to tackle are completely different. I think in a way, too, that like you can see about her movies that the stories are always about some kind of fish out of water trying to fit in.
Oh.
And I think that is her career in a nutshell early on. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That she's like part of this glamorous filmmaking family and, you know, all this pressure to be part of that. And, you know, I know, too, that she moved around a lot as a kid because she, you know, Coppola was going all over the place shooting this and that. And so she was constantly going into like new environments and having to make friends. And that'll do something to you, too. So I think like oftentimes you see that in her movie, you know, what happens when sort of a stranger like penetrates an already formed culture.
Right.
Can I just make a pitch for another Coppola, Roman Coppola, made a film about independence in a very different way. It is a 90s comedy called The Spirit of 76, the premise of which is people from the future have lost touch with American democracy and have to come back in time to learn about it from the founders. But they go to 1976 instead of 1776. And it is a very delightful and underenjoyed pot comedy that people should fall in love with. I'm sorry for railroading things. Does anyone else have any other major works of independence they would like to discuss?
I mean, there's Control. There's Justin's Justified.
First solo work. Is a very specific.
Yeah, I don't think that works independence anymore. Move. I don't think that it works anymore. I mean, I like Henry's or Harry, whoever his. See, I
Harry's,
don't even know him.
Harry Styles.
I literally called
like, who's Henry?
Fifth Direction the other day. I, you know, like Britney doing Blackout, which you can argue for or against Blackout, but she made it in the height of her mental breakdown. And I think there's something beautiful, even though I know that now she's under this awful, what do you call it?
Conservatorship
through her parents. And so she has no control over anything. They tell her exactly what to do. But if you're going to go out in style. And Blackout as an album is cohesive and structured in such a way that I feel like it's the last time we got raw Britney. We've not had a raw Britney since then. She wrote most of those songs or collaborated with whomever was writing them. And it was at the height of her mental breakdown. She was every single song is honest. And I just think that for all intents and purposes, this is a declaration of independence because this is like her SOS. She didn't know if she was ever going to get a chance again to be as honest as she wanted to be.
In the same vein, the boy bands of the 90s, when they were broke with Lou Pearlman.
Yeah.
NSYNC's No Strings Attached, obviously, which became like the hugest selling album of all time when it came out. And I think Millennium was a post-Pearlman album too.
Yeah.
By the Backstreet Boys. So it really, what it did was in that peak moment, like 99 into the first couple of years of the aughts, give us the sort of pop music transition from, you know, like that kind of stayed like overproduced boy band stuff to the shit that these guys really wanted to do in that idiom of boy band music.
Right.
So.
Right. And you know, even in that same vein, Mariah, when she left, what's his
Tommy
name?
Mottola.
Tommy Mottola. Mm. And she started doing
Butterfly was the first
Butterfly.
One, right?
And I mean, that's again, like anytime somebody can break free and do what it's touching is close to their soul. Like, I feel like they have a runway for about 2-3 albums and then somebody gets smacked right in the face with reality. Like, this person was a psychopath, but they were actually guiding you somewhere.
Go ahead, Margaret.
I just wanted to raise a flag for Thelma and Louise.
Okay.
Was probably, I think, the first movie that I watched that was like a really dark, a dark way of expressing independence. I mean, given what the ending is, I won't spoil it for those who haven't seen
oh,
it.
God.
It was Callie Corey kind of saying, here are all of your traditions of road movies. They were built not for me. I am going to take this road movie off road.
Yeah, I mean, Callie Curry being the screenwriter who is maybe like 30 years old or something like that, and looking around at what kind of movies have been told about women and seeing really nothing, and deciding to take specifically like outlaw movies, which have always been male territory, and saying what happens when there are two women who are outlaws when they're on the run, and that what they're on the run for is actually pretty justified, and I think has an interesting correlation to what's going on now in terms of cop violence against black communities and so forth. I mean, basically, you know, to what sets off the kind of Thelma and Louise being on the run is that there's an attempted rape and one of them shoots the rapist. And so they're off on the run and they keep talking about how, well, we could talk to the cops, but we don't trust the cops to protect us. And I think right now that is such a salient message, considering, like, you know, what happens when, you know, a black woman in Seattle calls cops to her house to be helped with a, you know, a burglary that she thought that was going on.
Yeah.
There's something so beautiful about that movie is that Harvey Keitel having the one police officer
who actually cares,
who kind of understands and is reaching out a hand, and like that it does not present just sort of like a uniform scary face, but like the possibility of there being an attempt at understanding and still having the guts to say, it's not enough. We're going off of this cliff.
Yeah.
Like your half-assed attempts at empathy when it works for you aren't going to work.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, another movie that I saw very recently that I also think plays into the independence idea is Confirmation, which is the movie that Kerry Washington made about the Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas hearings.
Yeah.
And if you guys haven't seen that, I kind of slept on it. I didn't, you know, I remember when it came out, but I just didn't see it at the time. And then when I was doing a story on Kerry Washington, I went back and watched it. And it is so good, in part because she plays a completely different kind of powerful woman than the Scandal character.
Yeah.
You know, she really embodies like Anita Hill's kind of awkward but super intelligent aura. And so she, in the movie itself, does a good job of not exactly telling you who you should necessarily believe. I mean, it's pretty clear to me and just about anyone who would watch it who you should believe. Yeah. But it plays it evenly in a very interesting, smart way.
It does such a nice job of starting out with an Anita Hill who is a Yale grad, brilliant, like, attorney, but somebody who, like, plays by the rules because she's a lawyer. Why not play by the rules? And sort of like somebody having to find power and declare independence from a power structure in a way that like costs her irreparably for the rest of her life, but like gives her a sense of ownership. And I just felt that Kerry Washington picked a really interesting middle ground so that she was not making this woman into just simplicity of glamour and power,
right,
but really respecting the honest journey of the actual Anita Hill.
Right, and that Anita Hill had trepidation about coming out about this story, didn't even necessarily want to do it in the beginning, and through the process gained a lot more confidence in it, even though the process in essence was turning against her.
Right.
You know, you see in the hearings that, like, you know, these guys are just running ramshot on her all the time and not really clearing space for her to give her story a proper hearing.
Right.
We asked people on the Facebook group if they were going to have an Independence Day themed film fest, what films would they pick?
There's only two.
No, we have more than that. Julie Kennison said There Will Be Blood, Idiocracy, and Mars Attacks. I think those are delightful. Amber Wilkins said 12 Years a Slave should be included in there. To include how America made so much of its wealth off of the backs of free or low-cost labor. Hadia Bigelow suggested Do the Right Thing, Birth of a Nation, the 1930s version, and Gone with the Wind. Oh, Song of the South, 12 Years a Slave, The Color Purple Platoon. That's awesome. Oh, what?
No, I was just going to say, you know, it is worth pointing out that we're recording this, even though this is going to run closer to Independence Day, we're recording it on June 19th.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's pretty interesting as sort of like a twin way to think about independence.
Yeah.
Those two.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of which, you can always tie the narrative to Boys in the Hood, because the choice to either stay in the hood and keep it real or to get out of the hood and just be whitewashed or whatever they would have called someone like myself and declare your independence from that environment by still keeping it real, that you can have a field day with that discussion.
Yes.
Go on Facebook and do that for us, Winter. Have a field day with
right
it.
Start it right Twitter. Now.
You're listening to Pop Rocket. We're going to be right back after this.
Gaetje McFadden, Marina Sirtis,
Larissa Inbatur,
LeVar Burton, Patrick Stewart look like movie stars.
Yeah.
Everybody else is like, you should just be on TV.
Sort of like when podcasters do this live.
Yeah.
Ben, the Greatest Generation is going back out on tour.
We're taking a new show out on tour about Star Trek First Contact. And whether or not you're a Star Trek fan, I think you're going to love this live show.
You come to our live show, you get Star Trek jokes. You get fart jokes. The whole gamut.
So come on out. It's bit.ly/ggtour2017. That's bit.ly/ggtour2017.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are...
Winter Mitchell.
Margaret Wappler.
And Karen Tongson.
Every week on Pop Rocket, we ask our panel, what's your current jam? Margaret Wappler, what is your current jam?
Well, because a lot of independence to me has been really ratified in years of my life where I've had big breakups, I decided to play Cat Power's Lived in Bars, which was an album. The album is the greatest. And I got into this album when it came out in 2006, which was also when I had busted up this like 10, 11 year relationship in my life. And let me just say, this was a year that I quite frequently lived in bars. And I needed it, and it was good for me. So here you go. We know your house so very well. We will bust down your door if you're not.
That's fun and swingy.
Yeah. One of the things I really love, I mean, Cat Power, I can just listen to her sing anything because she's got that beautiful, smoky voice, and the phrasing that she uses is so evocative. And I'm wondering, where the hell is she?
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
I was going to ask you that question.
Yeah.
Like, because she does have a hard time performing live.
Yeah,
she
and
flips out. So,
she does,
you know.
And I was going to say this too about her as a model of independence. She suffers quite a bit from depression, bipolar, but she always does get out there and perform eventually. Even when she fucks it up, she gets back out there and does it. And I know she recently went off and had a kid, so maybe she's just like plunged into kidland right now, but I really want to see her back and I want to hear what she would do now.
Karen Tarson, you got yourself a jam?
I do have a jam. I'm not sure if it's related to independence, but it's certainly about swagging and strutting. And it's The Killers' new single. I think it's their first single for a very long time.
Yeah,
since probably 2008 or 2009.
Wow.
Who knows where they've been, but they've just made a song that I'm going to play for you today called The Man. Baby, I'm gifted. You see what I mean? USDA certified lead. I'm the man. So you hear it's got a little bit, it's a little Bee Gees-esque.
Yeah.
There's something evocative, very strutty, staying alive about it. My wife Sarah and I were having a conversation about it because we both enjoy this song. And we were like, well, you know, is it a parodic take on masculinity in some way? And it is a little bit. I think, you know, like... USDA choice, you know, lean, right?
These kinds of things. I think they always have a little bit of that, like, wink-winkness to their songs.
They definitely have a wink-winkness. I always enjoyed their music, and I'm glad to see they're coming back onto the pop landscape, and I hope this is indicative of what their next album's going to sound like.
That's pretty fun. Winner, you got a jam?
Yeah, I was just sitting in the car and... listening to music like I always do, and this song came on, and I haven't heard Death Certificate in a really long time by Ice Cube. Ice Cube got a star on the Walk of Fame, mm-hmm. which is kind of amazing. I really love Ice Cube. I mean, his contribution, talk about independence, I mean, you can speak about Independence pretty heavily on him alone.
He solves crimes. He teaches Bill Maher things.
Jesus Christ. The man can do anything. So this song is called My Summer Vacation, and it's been getting a lot of rotation in our house because I think everybody right now is declaring independence.
They call the next day, set up shop, and it's better than slanging in the valley. Triple the profit, making more than I did in Cali. Breaking up rocks like Barney Rubble, cause them rock ass niggas don't want trouble. And we ain't on edge when we do work. Police don't recognize the khakis and the sweatshirts. Getting bitches, and they can't stand a 1991 Tony Montana. Not a shit's like a.
You know, there's gonna come a time where rappers can't say Barney Rubble because no one will know what they're talking about.
Exactly. Jay-Z's releasing, I don't know what this project is. It could be anything. It's with Sprint, so who knows. But I'm just curious. Jay-Z's 47, and what do you have? You're really rich. You're married to Beyonce. You haven't put it out on the album in like 5 or 6 years. Like, what do you have to say? I'm scared for him.
He's just going to collaborate with Coldplay or something weird like that.
You know what I mean? I'm just like, what do you have to say?
He and Mike Pence are going to do something.
Yeah.
He's probably going to get like Kendrick Lamar and like really good, high quality people. Up in like, there. Yeah, exactly. He'll be like fresh in the show up for me.
All right. My jam for this week is just, it's Independence Day. So I thought we needed to hear this.
And let it shine just on the night.
Rocketeers, you are fireworks.
This song came out right after my last major breakup, so I do feel it as a declaration of independence.
Guys, we just played 2 Katy Perry songs in a row. The show and the last show. So we have to take 2 weeks off from Katy Perry.
Well, there's a show in between this one and that one.
Oh, that's true.
I feel bad for her.
I think we're single. Pop Rocket is single-handedly throwing Katy Perry a lifeboat here.
Yeah, pick it up.
She made things rough for herself.
Ooh.
You have been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with Winter Mitchell, Margaret Wobbler, and Karen Toxin. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to Woody Battaglia and KKTY Bayside.
Woody Battaglia has been a fan of the show for a long time. So what? I want to know what gave him.
I'm just glad that it finally showed up. Thanks to them for the 5-star reviews on iTunes. If you haven't already, please review us. Get in touch with us on Twitter. We are at Pop Rocket, or join our Facebook group and join in the discussion. We are a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producers are Kara Hart and the understanding Christian Duenas.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.